Hi, I'm Erica Farber, President and CEO of the REB, and welcome to Radio on Main Street, the podcast all about radio. Our latest podcast series focuses on one of radio's greatest and most special assets, our on-air talent. As we continue to say, radio was the original social medium, and its on-air personalities are the original social media influencers. Some of these radio influencers have greater reach and followers than that of other media. They have incredibly strong ties to local communities that's based on a foundation of trust and emotional connection. As individuals who entertain, educate, and inform, radio influencers have the power to impact and affect behavior and brand consideration. On a daily basis, they create environments that connect their audiences with businesses to help drive brand awareness and increase sales for those businesses, products, and services. In our fourth podcast of the series, we hear the conversation I had with Mistress Carrie, a true rock radio on-air icon. She's a proud military wife and was the first non-news journalist embedded in the Middle East with the U.S. military in Iraq in 2006 and Afghanistan in 2011.
I'm Mistress Carrie. I am the host of the Mistress Carrie radio show, which can be heard on over 40 radio stations around the country. I'm also the host of the Mistress Carrie podcast, which is a rock lifestyle podcast available wherever you get your podcasts. I also host my own video streaming show that is on weekly called Cocktails in the War Room. It talks about music and current events and charity work. And I also am the owner and CEO of my own production company called Bigfoot First Productions.
I have to take a deep breath here. You've got a lot going on.
I do.
And it all started with a radio show.
It all started with a radio internship way back in the day. But yeah, it all started with the radio and continues to be anchored in the radio.
Well, share a little bit about that story, getting an internship, and how did that happen?
Well, I always loved music growing up, rock music specifically. And in the MTV generation, we got to see the behind the scenes of music. And I always saw the recording engineers kind of sitting in these massive studios in front of these giant consoles. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to do that? And in my mind, recording studios recorded rock bands. So I thought, oh, I could be the person that knows what all those knobs do and record Motley Crue. And how amazing would that be to kind of be in that world? And they didn't really have college for that. So I ended up going to a radio and kind of audio production major in college for my first couple of years. And I thought, well, if I can learn to edit audio and kind of learn the basics of the equipment, I'll eventually get into the studio with Motley Crue. So after my first year of college, I got an internship at a recording studio in Massachusetts that's no longer open. And I spent the summer recording a 27-piece mariachi band, literally one maraca at a time. And I was like, this is not Motley Crue. Like, this is not what I imagined. And spending the summer in that studio, I realized, like, recording studios record whoever comes in.
Right.
It's not like I would just get to work with rock bands all the time. And while I liked it, I realized that it wasn't what I was passionate about. And I think that was a really important lesson for me, that sometimes it's not learning what you love, but learning what you don't love.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of helps you steer your career. So it just so happened that WAF, the radio station I grew up listening to, was around the corner from the recording studio. And a girlfriend that I had grown up with, who was at the same college as me, was working in the promotions department that summer as an intern. And so I was waiting for her in the lobby to go out for lunch. And every once in a while, I had delivered commercials from the recording studio to the radio station. And the production director walked by, this guy named Mitch Todd, who's still in the industry today, who's got this amazing, big, booming radio voice. And he was like, who are you? And what are you doing here? And kind of joking.
Did you know who he was when you saw him?
I had no idea. I had no idea. But I knew he was doing something behind a microphone because his voice is unmistakable. Like, there's nothing else in the world Mitch Todd could do than work behind a microphone.
Right.
And so when I told him who I was and what I was doing, he said, how do you like your internship? And I told him, you know, I like it, but it's not really what I'm passionate about. He said, why don't you intern for me for the rest of the summer?
Wow.
And so I interned for the rest of that summer in the production department, watching him put imaging together, watching him put commercials together. Every once in a while, he needed a girl's voice for something and he would use me, and I would leave with a cassette of me on a commercial for some auto dealer or whatever. And I thought, oh my God, this is amazing.
And at the time, they probably did not have any female voices on the air.
I don't think they did. Not at WAF at the time. No.
Right.
And so I was like, wow, okay, this is cool. So I graduated with my associate's degree, transferred to a college close to WAF because I was at that point a commuter, mm-hmm. and got an internship with the morning show. And so I used to get up at like 3:30 in the morning, get ready for school, go and intern for the morning show until like 10:30 in the morning, and then drive 20 minutes down the road and go to college full time. Leave college, race home to work at my family business so that I could put gas in my gas tank. And I did that for my second 2 years of college while I was interning at AAF and then working at my family's bakery on the weekend, just trying to make ends meet. And then right before I graduated with my bachelor's degree, I got hired on the street team, the promotions team at WAF, like driving the van, handing out bumper stickers, making like $375 an hour, but I was on the payroll. And so I took that job and then got a job in a mall part-time because I needed to pay my student loans back.
Make ends meet.
Yeah. And then because I kind of had common sense and was really quick at kind of picking things up, all of the concerts that we were at because of the street team and WAF, I started becoming friends with the local crews and the band's crews. And then I got a job working as a roadie for like $10 an hour. And so I was balancing these jobs. Eventually, I got to give up the job at Spencer Gifts at the mall. Yeah. Was working full time as a roadie and was touring like all around the Northeast, building stages and light shows. But when I would come off the road, I always kept my job at WAF.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks, but then I'm going to be home for 2.5 weeks. You can schedule me for anything you deem before. And then I'm going to be gone for a couple more weeks or whatever. And this was at the time of, you know, this is mid-90s here. This is 95, 96, 97. Opie and Anthony had taken over WAF. It was just crazy. New metal had taken over rock and roll. And this was the center of the hurricane of rock music being at AAF at the time. And Opie and Anthony were doing so well that they needed a producer. And I thought, I've applied for every other job that's full time at WAF. Howard Stern as Robin, maybe Opie and Anthony would like to have a female producer. And so I put a demo tape together with my own voice because I didn't know what else to do. I applied for the job, didn't get it, ironically, because I didn't have the production chops they were looking for, even though I started this whole thing in a recording studio.
That's crazy.
And the program director at the time, Dave Douglas, had said, have you ever thought about being a DJ yourself? And I laughed off the notion. I was like, what am I going to do? Go on the radio and be like, hi, this is Metallica and I'm Carrie. And like, I laughed it off. And when I left, I went back down to the studio and Opie and Anthony were like, how did it go? And I told him what happened. And they were like, well, what did you say? And I said, no, that I wasn't interested. And, you know, I've said this many times. I may be the only person that's happy that I took career advice from Opie. But he said, he gave me really tough love and it was a huge life lesson for me. He said, are you stupid? Like, this is one of the most influential rock stations in the country. Hundreds of people apply to get on the air.
Right.
They basically just offered you a job and you laughed it off.
Yeah.
Turn around, go back down there and tell them yes. And at the time, I had been at AAF for 7 years. I was an unpaid intern. I was the first woman they ever hired to work on their street team, driving their vehicles, setting up their equipment and all of that. And I went back down with my tail between my legs to Dave Douglas. And I said, you know, I love the station. You know, I want to be here. I'll do whatever you think I'm capable of. And if you think I would make a good DJ, then yes. And within 2 months, one of the part-timers got fired. They offered me the job and I did 8 weeks in a row of like late night shifts, early morning shifts, the way radio part-timers come up.
Right.
And Opie and Anthony got fired from that famous April Fool's joke in 98. They moved the night guy to afternoons and they were like, we've got this girl. We're just going to throw her on the air at night on WAF and see what happens. And my first night as a full-time radio DJ was April 17th, 98. And I never looked back.
Well, so first of all, a great life lesson, never close that door and be open to opportunity.
Yes.
We will have some people listening to this who are not aware of who Opie and Anthony are, nor are they aware of the demise of Opie and Anthony, as you will. But so I think it's important just to say that there are some boundaries that you can't cross. Sometimes it can destroy a person's career. And so you were really, you'd put your time in, but boy, you were at the right place at the right time.
I got really lucky, but as people say about luck, it's all about being prepared for when the opportunity comes.
No question.
And I had really shown my loyalty, my willingness to learn. I was available. I never said no. Whatever I have to do to be here, I just love it here and I want to be here. And I set the table for me to be able to take advantage of that opportunity.
And would you say that's when Mistress Carrie was born?
So I started on the air and at first I was just by Carrie. You know, there were no women on the air at that time. Between when I started as an intern and when Opie and Anthony took over, Liz Wilde had had a tenure there very successfully on the air in the afternoon. They knew that a woman could work on a station like WAAF, but it had to be the right one. So when they put me on the air at night, for a little while, it was just Carrie. But nights at WAAF was no holds barred. The heaviest music, the craziest subject matter. They basically just threw me in there. And literally Dave Douglas on the first night said, figure it out, kid, and shut the door behind me. So after a couple of months, I think, people started calling me and they were like, I spend every night with you. It's like you're the other woman in my life. It's like I have a mistress, but my wife knows about it. And so it became this really organic Mistress Carrie thing. Then I started airing the phone calls of people calling me that. Then the radio station made bumper stickers that had Mistress Carrie on it. And because I kind of fit the look that I'd always had purple hair, always wore all black, like I just looked like that, it stuck. So it wasn't something where we sat down in a marketing meeting and said, we need this catchy radio name. Like the listeners gave me that name.
So it was truly organic.
It was truly organic and it stuck.
That's so great. So may I call you Carrie?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Carrie, yeah. From your perspective now, because you've had such a rich career on the radio and certainly have made your mark, what do you think makes great radio?
In my experience, which is incredibly limited because I had this really strange opportunity to stay in the same city at the same station for 29 years. So while a lot of people have had the experience of moving around and experiencing different audiences up until 3 years ago when AAF went off the air, my experience was limited to Massachusetts, to Boston, and to WAAF. So I always feel weird making comments about radio in general, because for so long, I was so limited in my scope of knowledge.
But you've also had different managers throughout the years. You didn't have the same program director or general manager that whole time.
Yeah, that's true for sure. And now that I've spent the last 3 years on a bunch of different stations around the country and gotten to learn the differences, I think specifically in rock radio, which is the only place I've ever worked, I think great rock radio is being authentic. I think in the rock genre, it's hard to fake that. And the audience can smell it. So if you're going to be in rock radio, living the lifestyle, knowing the music, really being able to speak honestly and authentically to the audience about the things that they love, because rock radio is very tribal. Right. And So I think you need to be authentic with them. And I think the content needs to be as original as possible, that you need to have a reason for them to not listen to Spotify or to not listen to Apple Music. And the more local and original the content you can make it, I think all the better, which is becoming harder and harder all of the time because there are so many people like myself that are doing radio outside of the market that they live in.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to work even harder to make sure that you are ingraining yourself into the community as much as you can. And that can be really difficult sometimes, learning pronunciations, learning colloquialisms. If you come from New England, there's plenty of places that people don't know how to pronounce and plenty of inside jokes that people outside of New England don't understand.
Sure.
And it's like that around the rest of the country too. But I think the biggest selling point for radio has always been that it's live and it's local. And I think that that selling point, while I see more and more of it going away, is still the most important part of radio, is that you're active in the community and you're involved. You're live and local there.
How do you prep for a show?
I feel like I'm always prepping. Mm-hmm. So on my podcast, I do weekly episodes that have guests. It's a rock lifestyle podcast. So I interview rock bands. I interview instrument manufacturers, roadies, you know, record company people, anybody that has anything to do with the music we love. I talk to them. I also have a feature on my podcast called The Sit Rep. And that comes out Monday through Friday, really early in the morning. It publishes at like 3:30 a.m. And it's around 5 minutes long, and it's rock news, music headlines, and kind of entertainment updates, really mass appeal stuff. If it's not rock, it's mass appeal stuff. And it's basically just to kind of keep you informed on kind of what's going on that day. And in the show notes of each sit rep, I put the link. So if you're really interested in one headline that I touch upon, you know, you can go into the notes, hit the link, and read the whole story that I got from wherever. Right. And it also serves as, you know, a bibliography of where I'm citing my sources. And so I have to prep for the sit rep because it comes out 5 days a week. And you can listen to it while you're making your coffee or waiting to drop the kids off at school and then go about your day. And you kind of know everything that's going on. And I record it really late at night. So I've had a lot of morning show hosts tell me that they listen to my sit rep in the morning on their way to the studio.
So it's their show prep.
Yeah, because I record it like usually around midnight or one in the morning because I do afternoons on most stations. So I'm up late anyway.
Wow.
And so because I'm constantly show prepping for the sit rep, I'm constantly looking for stories to talk about on the radio. Mm-hmm. And the different radio shows that I do, I have to prep differently. I'm on a lot of classic rock shows. So classic rock radio is a little bit different. Some of the artists are no longer active. They're not making music. They're not touring. They're not alive. So yeah. You have to find things to talk about centered around that. Whereas the active rock stations that I'm on, the artists for the most part are really
current based.
So they're out on the road. They're in video games and movie soundtracks and touring and releasing new albums. So I'm constantly show prepping to feed my podcast, but also divvying up the show prep between the radio formats that I do. And so I'm always, when I'm in the studio, I'm constantly looking for stuff. I'm one of those people that has 10,000 browser windows open on my computer screen, which drives some people crazy.
Right.
And then I'm always, if I have downtime, even at night when I'm watching TV, I'm always kind of scrolling through my phone just to make sure that I didn't miss anything. But I also, to go back to what you were talking about earlier, I live the lifestyle because this is the music I love.
Right.
It's what I've always loved. So I am genuinely, as a person, interested in the bands, in the music, because it's what I love. So that part of it, I don't really view as work, because I was always one of those people that wanted to know what my favorite bands were doing and what was going on. And now I've been fortunate enough to have a career where I'm friends with a lot of these artists.
Mm-hmm.
And those relationships are what get me the interviews and the personal interviews that I get from my podcast that I then use on the air. So right. There's really never a time when I'm not show prepping for something.
You know, you spoke about the connection that you have with your listeners. Can you share a specific story that talks about that special relationship you have with your audience?
I think the most glaring example, and I've talked about it a lot, but there's some of the most proud moments that I've ever had on the radio were the trips that I made overseas to get embedded with troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think anybody that was on the air on 9/11 knew that our jobs were completely changing. In rock radio, we blew out the commercials, blew out the music. We became news talk stations.
Right.
And for rock radio specifically, the target demographic are the people that would be putting the uniforms on and going to war. Mm-hmm. And my stance coming from a first responder and military family was always, look, it's up to the politicians and the constituents to argue about the war and whether or not we should be sending our troops there. That's for politicians and voters to decide. The troops have nothing to do with that. And it's our job to support them no matter what they do. Mm-hmm. And so as the war started after 9/11, I would get calls and emails from mothers and fathers and siblings and spouses that their loved ones were getting deployed and they would want to donate songs to them. Or then I started getting care packages from local troops that were deployed overseas. And I started sending care packages back with Property of Mistress Carrie bumper stickers that are still probably stuck all over Iraq and Afghanistan.
Love that.
And then I started getting calls from listeners saying, hey, the USO just had the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders over here. Could you come and visit us? We would rather see you.
Wow.
And it took me from about 2004 to 2006 to really investigate every avenue, including the USO, which I didn't kind of qualify for because I was more regionally known than nationally known. Mm-hmm. But I applied for the Embedded Reporter Program. And I was the first non-news journalist to get embedded in Iraq and Afghanistan with U.S. troops. And I not only had to apply and go through the screening process and get all the shots and get trained and all of that, but the troops had to accept the responsibility of having a civilian journalist embedded with them. And you're taking up a seat.
They're protecting you as well.
They're protecting you. Yeah. And so to have local Massachusetts troops say, we will take the liability and the bullseye it's going to put on our back to accept a female American journalist mm-hmm. with purple hair to come here. And it wasn't like I stayed on the base and, you know, you see the USO shows and they're all wonderful, but I was going on patrols. I was in convoys. I was leaving the base. I was out on the road exposed, and these troops were willing to literally, without trying to be dramatic, take a bullet for me.
Right.
And so if that doesn't show the power of a relationship that's possible between a radio broadcaster and their audience, I don't know what does. It took me 2 years to get the Iraq trip approved through the Pentagon. It took 18 hours for me to get the trip to Afghanistan approved by the same channels because everybody just plowed the road and they were like, yep, she can do whatever she wants, send her. And I made a promise to those troops overseas, you've got my back here. When you get home, I will have your back.
Got your back.
And so I have spent since 9/11, but definitely since I came home from Iraq and Afghanistan, advocating for better treatment for our veterans, better medical treatment, post-traumatic stress treatment, suicide prevention treatment, legislation, resources for their families. And it turned into something that, besides the purple hair, besides the relationships with the rock bands, probably what I'm most known for in my career. And it all started because of the relationship that I had with my audience.
Well, it can't get any deeper than that.
No, it's really, really powerful. And now I'm married to an active duty Marine. And so now I have seen the other side mm-hmm. of what it's like to be a military spouse at home while your loved one is deployed overseas. And it's been a very huge learning experience for me to experience that side of it as well.
I'm sure. And we certainly thank him for his service. It's, people that have not been directly affected really don't know what it's about.
And it's hard to imagine with 20 years of war, people not being affected, but it's always staggering to me that so much of the population doesn't have someone that is a veteran or that is serving or has served in the military. And I really try to bridge the gap because I think if veterans could solve veterans' problems, they would have already been solved.
Yes.
It's going to take the other 97% of the population to advocate on the behalf of people that they don't know. And so I spend a lot of my time kind of translating between the military experience that I have, even though, and I'm very quick to say, I never served myself. I could never understand what it was really like to be in uniform, but I've seen more than most. Mm-hmm. And to be able to explain my experiences and to advocate on behalf of the military to the rest of America that just kind of sits home and watches the news and thinks, oh, well, if something were really bad going on, I would hear about it. And so my relationship with the military community and the veteran community is something that I work extremely hard on and that I'm very proud of.
Well, and we thank you for continuing to keep that at the forefront of your messaging. When you were telling the story of 9/11 and what you did was not unusual, and many stations that were commercial did not run commercials and went all talk, if you will, but it's these advertisers that allow us to do what we do. And so that's a very special relationship. And if you had a short period of time, Carrie, to convince an advertiser why they should include radio in their marketing plans, what would you say to an advertiser?
I think that advertising with radio, and specifically working directly with the talent, is the fastest and most powerful and productive way to actually get straight to the consumer. Because the relationship between a listener and an air talent at a radio station is something that goes above and beyond just, you know, watching funny videos on an app. That listener chooses every day to allow that radio host to be part of their day. We spend sometimes more time with our audience than their loved ones do. They've got the radio on all day at work. They're with us in the car on their way to work, on their way home from work. And there's a trust that develops there. So when you have that relationship and that on-air host, the way that I always pitch advertising, because now that I own my own company and have my podcast, I have to sell advertising for my own business on top of having sales departments at the radio station. So I finally understand what it's like to be a salesperson, which I never understood before. And I always put the advertiser as the hero in the scenario, because the listeners always hear the crazy things that we're always doing and the great contests that we're doing and the awesome prizes. And the way that I always deliver it is, none of this would be possible if we didn't have the advertiser helping to make it happen. And if you make the advertiser part of the heroic line of the whole thing, like, look, you know me, I love doing crazy stuff, but you know that the company's not going to write a check for me to do crazy stuff. But these people at this credit union believed this crazy idea enough to write me a check to make it happen. They're the heroes of it. That's something that a video on an app or whatever can't do that working with radio can, is that radio has the ability to make the advertiser the hero. And when that is delivered through an on-air host that the audience loves, that resonates better than whatever voice you use and whatever snappy commercial you produce, whatever color red you use in a graphic that gets seen on Facebook. That still resonates, and that is the power of radio.
I love that. The advertiser is the hero.
They are.
You talked about a credit union. Can you share a specific example of a product or service that you endorse and how you handle that endorsement?
Specifically talking about on the radio, I have a sponsor on one show here in Massachusetts, who is an attorney who specializes in motorcycle accidents. Hmm. And as a motorcycle rider, I can speak on that because there is still a stigma when you see bikers, regardless of how open-minded everyone would like to believe the world is. And when a biker is the victim of an accident, and I say the victim because most of the time the motorcyclist is the victim, not the person that caused the accident, sometimes you're not going to be represented or viewed in a court as the victim because you don't look a certain way, coming from the purple-haired girl with the tattoos and the skull on her glasses. And so attorney John Haymond has been sponsoring my show for years, back in the old AAF days when I started my new ventures on all of these other stations, including the Pike here in Worcester. He was like, I want to work with Carrie again. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the biker lifestyle. It's all about getting the word across that he rides. All the lawyers in his law office ride motorcycles, and they understand what it's like to be a biker and need effective representation in a courtroom if you get into a motorcycle accident.
Well, you can't get more authentic than that.
And that's authentic. You know, I've done endorsements for national chains for their iced coffee because I'm very famously a lover of iced coffee. So I really try to take on endorsements and work with clients that I use and that I really feel passionate about. And also, especially in the last few years, since I started my own production company, mm-hmm. and I'm not under contract with any one specific broadcasting company or station, that I also hold the right to turn down working with companies that I don't want to work with.
Right.
Which is not something that a lot of air talent that are under contract with one company at one station can sometimes say, no, I don't, for whatever the reason is, I don't want to work with that company. And that was also something that I really wanted and was important to me because I really try to ingrain myself in a relationship with the advertisers. And if I don't believe in it, if I have a philosophical disagreement with the company or whatever, I don't want to be put in a position where I feel like I'm lying to the audience. So I can say no, mm-hmm. but that doesn't really happen.
And with your podcast, are you integrating advertising within your podcasts? And how are you doing that? Because monetizing podcasts is certainly a real growth area for many podcasters.
It is. And when I started, you know, like I said, being on the radio and having a sales department, this was a learning curve for me. I had to learn how to function without an IT department, an engineering department, a production department, and a sales department. And so first I went out and started looking for direct advertising, me serving as the AE, going out and working with direct advertisers. After about 6 months, I was approached by a podcast network that specializes in music-based podcasts called the Pantheon Podcast Network. Mm-hmm. And when I joined Pantheon, they have the ability, if I put tones in my podcast, to do dynamic ad insertion. So if the network dynamically inserts ads, the rates get purchased based on CPM, cost per thousand. So it's all based on hard data of downloads alone.
Right.
What I like to do is sell direct advertising myself as often as I can, mm-hmm. because that advertising is 360 Mistress Carrie. So it's not just cost per thousand of the downloads of the podcast, but it's also my website mentions and links. It's all of the social media promotion that they get attached to. If it's a local advertiser, I offer up hosting charity events for them, doing appearances for them. And
so those advertisers are really connecting with you as a spokesperson in everything that you do.
Yes. Yeah. Outside of the radio.
Right.
I have very specific lines of, I don't go after advertisers that the radio stations have as clients on my radio shows because I'm mm-hmm. a contractor on those stations.
Right.
But when I go out and sell advertising myself, it's about attaching yourself to the Mistress Carrie brand. Now, I have had cases where I've had advertisers come and want to sponsor my podcast. They've wanted me to host events for them. And then if it works, they'll go, you know what? We want to spend more money and we want to sponsor your radio show too. And then I say, that's great. Here's the sales guy's phone number. You guys work that out.
That's great.
And then I can work out on the other end with the radio station appearance fees, endorsement fees for the radio aspect of it. But when it comes to selling Mistress Carrie as a brand, I try to make the advertiser as much as a part of all of it, and not just, oh, I'm going to throw a 1 minute live read at the beginning, you know, the pre-roll of a podcast episode.
Right. So Carrie, can you finish the sentence, radio works because?
Radio works because of the relationship between the station and the on-air talent and the audience. And that relationship, I think, is the most important thing. And I think if you take that relationship away or you put barriers in between it, it makes it more difficult. It's not impossible because I am successful on the radio in places where I don't live. But that immediacy and that relationship, I think, is something radio has that no other media has. And I think it's the thing, unfortunately, that we're seeing slip away the fastest. And I think it's the most important thing. I can't go get gas. I can't go to go groceries. I can't go anywhere without someone somewhere coming up to me to talk to me about some concert that we sent them to, some interview that they heard, some crazy contest that they won, some memory that they have, including 9/11. People come up to me all the time and they're like, I remember exactly where I was. I put the radio on. I knew you guys were going to shoot it straight. And you guys, whenever I see footage of 9/11 or I remember you guys talking me through that. That relationship to me is the most important thing. And I realize it comes from a talent, but I think we have the closest relationship to the end user of radio, which is the listener. And I think we, as the talent, know the listeners the best.
And those are the consumers of these advertisers' products and services.
Trust the air talent and keep them on the air.
And radio matters because?
Radio matters because in a world full of communication, if it's live and local and there's an air talent that really has a connection with the audience, that is a connection that no other medium can offer. I don't care how many Twitter followers you have or how many people are on TikTok watching your videos. There's still that barrier. The way that you feel like the anchor on the evening news isn't talking to just you. You know they're on television and they're not just talking to you. Radio takes a lot of those barriers away. And it makes the audience feel like we're just talking to them. And it's very special. And the thing that I hold most dear and why I still love what I do so much.
Well, Mistress Carrie certainly knows all about heroes. And at the same time, she makes quite a point of saying that the advertiser is the hero, in that they help to make it all happen in radio. Radio has the ability to resonate better than anything else because of the relationships. And a video or an app just can't do. She reminds us that our on-air talent has the closest relationship to the listener. So it's important we trust them and keep them on the air.
If you'd like to learn more about radio and its many benefits, we invite you to visit us at rab.com, or you can email us directly at askrab@rab.com. Until next time, it's Radio on Main Street.